You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A couple of weeks back, we checked in on the Christmas bird count. Maybe you were one of those observers out there with your pencil, your binoculars, your GPS. If you think about it, you were really doing research. You were, as a volunteer, tallying up feathered friends. And you really enjoyed it, I'll bet. But that's over, so now what are you going to do? You want to do something else? Well, do not fear, because there is a whole bunch of other ways for you to pitch in to do scientific research as a citizen scientist. How about counting moon craters? Would you like to do that? Or track backyard blossoms? You can measure the letters on gravestones. And if you're a little more adventurous, you can report back on roadkill. No joke. You can do that if you want. There are tons of projects out there, and that's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour. And maybe you're already involved in a project and you'd like to tell us about it and tell everybody how they might become involved. We'd like to hear about it. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can tweet us your citizen science project, writing the @ followed by SciFry. That's our tweet. But if you put the hashtag #citizenscience on there, so it's easy for people to find, that will help us too. You can put the hashtag #citizenscience on the tweet at Science Friday. Let me introduce my guests. Alex Wright is the author of GLUT, Mastering Information Through the Ages, and a contributor to the New York Times. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Arvin Smith is the technical lead for the Galaxy Zoo. That is a citizen science project. And the Zooniverse, it's a portal, an interesting portable with a bunch of citizen science projects on it. And that's out at the University of Oxford in England. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Smith.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about Zooniverse. What sort of projects can people find there?
Okay, so the Zooniverse is actually, our original project was Galaxy Zoo. So with Galaxy Zoo, we learned that people just by accessing our website can produce very rich data sets by classifying images of galaxies. So Galaxies Zoo asked people to just look at the shape of the galaxy and say what they saw. Now, the Zooniverse is an extension of that kind of concept, really, and it's they're all projects that we do where all you need is a web browser and some spare time, and we ask people to look at these large data sets that are too big for professional researchers to cope with. And we ask people to do a small amount of work to classify something about an image or a video, and basically build up this rich data set that we then use to do really quite advanced research with the results.
And you don't need any special training to do this.
No. This is the aim of our projects. Some of our projects have a brief tutorial, but some of them are so straightforward that you can really get going without even reading the tutorial. I can't believe I'm saying that. We put a lot of time into the tutorials, but a lot of them are really...
They're very good. I tried them myself. I can testify to that. But give us an idea of what one of your most favorite projects there is.
So my favorite project right now is probably called the Milky Way Project, which is looking at Spitzer. So Spitzer's a satellite that's out in above the Earth now, and it's staring at the galaxy and the galactic plane and looking at the distribution of gas and dust in our galaxy. And this is interesting because this is where stars, you can detect where stars are forming, and you can't see them with ground-based optical telescopes. So the Milky Way project is just the most beautiful project that we've done because the images are just stunning. Mm. They're really beautiful to look at.
Now, Dr. Smith, we asked if you had any ideas on how you could challenge our Science Friday listeners to get involved in citizen science, and you came up with something for us.
We did. So actually, on Monday in Seattle is the AAS meeting. So this is the American Astronomical Society. And this is the 217th meeting of the American Astronomical Society, no less. And my colleague, Dr. Rob Simpson, who is actually the project lead for the Milky Way Project, is flying out tomorrow morning to Seattle, and we'll be presenting some of the early results from the Milky Way Project, which has only been running for about a month. And for us, it's a relatively modest-sized project. There's something like 12,000 images in there. And so far, we've had about 80,000 inspections of those images. And what we'd really like to do is to kind of hit the 100,000 over the weekend. So and at 100,000, we've got about 10 repeats. And this is our first guess at what we think is a reasonable amount of classifications for this data set. So with your help, we would love to see we would love for Rob to be able to stand up on Monday and tell everybody that we'd hit 100,000.
Well, we'll try to get some more citizen scientists for you. If you want to help out Dr. Smith in this project, go to our website at sciencefriday.com.
Sure.
We have a link there to make it easy for you to get right to this project. We need 20,000 of you. We've got 100,000 tweeters. Come on, 20,000 of you can go over there and help finish that Galaxy project so they can get up there on Monday and say they had 100,000 Milky Way people helping them.
Absolutely.
Out.
And we've got a status. So you can see we've created the Galactometer. We have a history of making up stupid names for progress bars. So we have the Zoonometer for Galaxy Zoo and the Moonometer for Moon Zoo. And we have the Galactometer for the Milky Way project. So if you go to milkywayproject.org/NPR, you'll see our current target number. So
all right.
So you can check in and see how far you're getting along.
And if you got lost there, you can go to Science Friday, and we'll have all that stuff you need to find your way around there. Alex Wright, you just had a big piece in the New York Times about citizen science. Can you tell us about some of the other projects, citizen science projects that are going on around there?
Yeah, sure. I learned a lot researching the piece. There's really a lot going on right now, and I certainly think Galaxy Zoo is one of the great examples of a really successful project that's out there on the web right now. But in the last few years, it's really interesting that this area really seems to be taking off, and I think there are a number of interesting reasons for that. I think like a lot of people, my first exposure to citizen science was a project about 10 years ago called SETI at Home.
Oh, sure.
Do you remember that? And that was a project out of, partly sponsored by UC Berkeley, where they developed a piece of software where you could download it to your PC and it ran a screensaver, and then it would use your computer's idle processing cycles to crunch data coming in from extraterrestrial, from satellite telescopes.
Right.
In the wake of that, that technology has since been open sourced, and now there are a lot of projects out there where you can use the software. It's called BOINC. It stands for Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing. And a lot of other projects have now taken advantage of that to use this distributed computing infrastructure. So there are projects like Einstein at Home that looks at gravitational wave detection. There's the Rosetta at Home project looks at protein prediction. So there are a lot of these.
There's this
kinds
one
of
great that's folding proteins that I tried today.
That's right. That's another different project called Fold It. It's like a video game where you basically play with these objects that represent sequences of amino acids, and you try to fold these objects into the most optimal shapes.
And you're helping a scientist do that. That's his project.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the human mind could do it better than what a computer might do.
What they've found, what they're really trying to explore is whether our human brains have a certain facility for solving these kinds of problems, because it's actually a very difficult computational challenge. Proteins can have up to thousands of a thousand amino acids in them, and there are a lot of possible combinations, and it's hard work even for a computer to get through that. And so they found a way to take advantage of people's inherent problem-solving abilities without having to make them learn the subject matter.
So. Yeah, it's interesting. 1-800-989-8255. Joe in Tucson. Hi, Joe.
Okay. Hi there, Ira.
Hi there.
It's great to be with you. Yeah, well, this idea of citizen science, it's a great thing, and it's something I've done all my life, too. Also, a professional scientist here. But one of the things I like to do as an amateur scientist is keep track of the rainfall here in the desert.
Mm.
That's a really important thing because, you know, the rainfall can be very scattered and very spotty, that is, especially in our thunderstorm season. The thunderstorms are rather small in size, some of them, not covering a big area. So some areas get more rainfall than others, and the university here, the University of Arizona, developed a project to enlist the assistance of, neighbors. And I think so far about 350 of us have sprung up within the Tucson city area as well as the surrounding county. And it also extends up to Phoenix, which is a good 110 miles north.
So they're all reporting in on when they see a thunderstorm or a shower. They write it down or they tweet in or file it somehow?
The observation made is actually the recorded rainfall in your backyard. So you do need a rain gauge.
Right.
And you can get in rather, at ground floor level there, $5 or $6 for a nice plastic rain gauge. And just read it every morning at 7 o'clock and then type in the numbers after, you know, accumulating a month's worth, or else type them in immediately. And the great thing is that there's instant gratification. You see the results on a map of the state
right
instantly, and you can see what your neighbor got, half a mile away, how much you received, and there's also a cumulative chart showing how much each site has gotten up to date. So one of the fascinating things out there. Now, I know that there's also a project like this on the East Coast, too.
Yeah.
The one here in the desert is called Rainlog, rainlog.org.
All right. Thanks for calling.
There's also a project just worth mentioning called World Water Monitoring Day. I think it's in September every year, and that's actually been quite successful. It's an international effort. I think they're expecting about 1 million people in the next one to take part in 100 different countries. So that's another one worth
looking at. Aren't scientists worried that that people might get things wrong, that they're not good enough at collecting the data or just collecting because they're not analyzing it, right?
Sure. So citizen science ranges from, volunteer computing like SETI at home to volunteer data collection, so, bird watching, rain collection, things like this. And then those kind of quite carefully constructed experiences like Galaxy Zoo, where it's very difficult to do anything wrong at all. And I think one of the challenges of citizen science projects where you do kind of distribute the task of data collection is actually getting as a collection of researchers, sort of getting a good handle on the kind of errors associated with an individual measurement. Now, that's one of the hardest things in science. So it's just it is a problem, but I think it's a problem you can adjust for in your analysis. I think the benefits of having this distributed network of data points far outweighs the potential pitfalls of having a data set that isn't quite as good as if it had been the same individual taking measurements everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Alex, you agree?
Yeah, I agree, but it is a thorny problem. And I think Galaxy Zoo, I think, is lucky in that they have a large user base that they can do that kind of use that kind of redundancy to control for errors. But I think other smaller projects have a bit of a challenge. I know one of them, the Herbaria at Home project in the UK, has really just a couple of hundred images users who are classifying botanical images. And the way they've addressed that problem is to actually have their staff go through and do sort of a quality assurance check manually, right, which is very time-consuming and difficult to scale. So
I understand that your piece in the Times generated a little bit of controversy on the question of whether citizen scientists are really quote-unquote scientists.
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate, I think, who gets to call themselves a scientist. I was looking into it a little bit, and it's interesting. The word scientist is actually a pretty new word. It was coined in the mid-1800s. Before that, there was no such thing as a scientist.
And natural philosopher.
That's right. Yeah, looking further, right, they were philosophers, or there were a lot of them were monks and that sort of thing. So the idea of a professional scientist is a pretty new concept. On the other hand, we've had doctors and lawyers and accountants for a long time, right? So, and really, I think in the 20th century, you've seen science get increasingly professionalized and specialized. And so, now that, we have this technology that's inviting more people into the process, it sort of opens up the question of who gets to use that term. I think it's an open question at this point.
We're talking about citizen science this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatto talking with Alex Wright and Arvind Smith. Arvind, do you agree? That's a little... What is the definition of a scientist?
And I would not like to try and define it for you. I think that it's a very difficult question to answer. I have I am a doctorate of research. I have a degree in a PhD in what would be considered a pretty solid science in astrophysics, but yet still a huge amount of my time as a PhD student was spent just trawling through data, doing repetitive, hard work. I think I know what makes a successful scientist, and I think more often than not, it's hard work. A hard-working person usually makes a good scientist because they just put the hard work in that is just the kind of trawling through data, recording observations, and just not having eureka moments. I think maybe there's this idea in some people's minds that science is just a collection of deep insights. Unfortunately, very few of us have these revolutionary moments in our research careers. Most people just make small contributions that are an addition to the overall understanding of of the larger community. Mm-hmm. So I think science for me is, or the act, a scientist increases the knowledge of the human race. I think that's a scientist for me. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, one of the criticisms you hear about citizen scientists using the term sometimes is that a lot of what the activities that people are engaged in with these projects are fairly you could say, kind of low-level tasks. They're doing a lot of data collection and observation and not necessarily sort of doing the analysis and the interpretation of that data. But, you know, as you mentioned, the fact is a lot of scientists actually do spend quite a bit of time doing grunt work themselves.
Louis Leakey was on that floor at Alder Flying Course for 30 years with a toothbrush. Sweeping away the particles, and his wife found out what he was looking for after all those years. Yeah, and then you have theoretical scientists who do nothing but write stuff on a blackboard.
Right.
What guy, you know, they're not collecting data, they're not doing that kind of, they're doing thinking.
Right.
So science encompasses a lot of...
And I think just to add to that, there's varying levels of engagement. I mean, I think the person who comes to, you know, Galaxy Zoo is a website, so websites are notoriously not very sticky experiences for people. So lots of people who come to Galaxy Zoo come for about 10 seconds and then never come back. That's because it's the web.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that classify Galaxy and then maybe sit there and look a bit more carefully at the second one, then actually go on to the forum and say, hang on a minute, there's something weird going on here. They're already thinking about something about the galaxy. So they've already gone beyond, as far as I'm concerned, the very first level of interaction of, please just answer these three questions. Don't worry about what we're asking you. Just say what you see.
Mm-hmm. I would think this is also a great educational tool for kids to be involved and actually see what scientists do.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think a great example of what Dr. Smith just mentioned was actually on Galaxy Zoo. There was the user Hani Van Arkel who did just that. Went a little bit beyond just looking at the task that she was assigned, and she noticed something a little bit unusual in one of the photos. And she wrote to the project staff and asked them, "What is this thing?" And they went back and forth, and it took a little while. But eventually, it turned out that it was a new astronomical phenomenon that she discovered, and it's since been named after her. It's called Hani's Vorweep.
How old is she?
I believe she's in her 20s. She's a school teacher,
in
Holland.
28 or something,
All right. This is quite interesting. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more with Alex Wright and Arvin Smith. Our number 1-800-998-2255. If you want to talk about citizen science, we'll get into one more guest will come on and talk about another example of a project. And tell us what your projects are. 1-800-998-2555. You can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. And also go to our website at sciencefriday.com if you'd like to see and participate in some of these Science Friday projects. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about citizen science and all the projects you can get involved with my guests. Alex Wright, author of GLUT, Mastering Information Through the Ages. He's a contributor to the New York Times. Dr. Arvin Smith is the technical lead for the Galaxy Zoo and Zooniverse at the University of Oxford in England. I'd like to bring on another guest to talk about a project where you can log some scientific data while you're out there playing in the snow. Richard Kelly is the leader of Snow Tweets Project. He's a professor of geography at the University of Waterloo in Canada. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Kelly.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody.
So while you're making snow angels, you can do some science.
Absolutely. That's the idea. We're trying to see if we can leverage some of the Web 2.0 technologies that are out there to help us with some of the science that we do in terms of climatology and climate change.
And so what are you asking people to do?
Well, we're asking people to really look around them when they're outside and perhaps make a measurement of how much snow there is in their backyard or on their way as they drive along. They can perhaps make an estimate of snow depth. And then we're asking them to tweet that information through Twitter using a particular code. Not dissimilar to many of the types of hash codes or codes that are used on Twitter these days.
And what is that code?
It's actually hash snow tweets. The project is called Snow Tweets. So we use a hashtag, which is a hash snow tweets tag. And then all you do is you add in the depth of snow and the postcode for where you are, and then we'll do the rest.
So it will be hash snow tweets, let's say. Do you want it in inches, centimeters, or does it matter?
The nice thing is I have a couple of geniuses here who can who can figure out the difference between inches and centimeters. So it doesn't matter which way you do it.
Uh-huh. And how do you measure snow on the ground from space?
Well, that's really the substantive aspect of why we're doing this. I'm interested in global climatology of snow, how it's changing. I'm also interested in snow from a water resources perspective. We have satellites buzzing around in space right now that can actually do a pretty good job of telling us where the snow is. And there are several products that the National Weather Service and NOAA and also NASA have that tell us where the snow is. We can also have a go at estimating how much snow there is on the ground in terms of the snow depth, but these are a little bit more uncertain. So we need ground-based information and ground-based measurements to help us. And that's where the Snow Tweets project can potentially contribute to what we're doing.
And how many members do you have at this point?
Well, we are a small team of three, a professor and two very, very talented graduate students, Ray Cabrera and Josh King.
All right. Well, we'll see what we can do to get you some more tweets there.
Thank you very much.
Richard Kelly, thanks for being with us. He's leader of the Snow Tweets Project and professor of geography at the University of Waterloo in Canada. And again, if you want to participate in that, the hashtag is #SnowTweets. Then follow that by the depth of the snow and where you, with the zip code or postal code of where you found that information. Also with us in the studio is Alex Wright and Arvin Smith. That seems like a very interesting little project, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. That seems, I was not familiar with that one. That's a great example.
And it's a simple thing to do, and anybody can do it and be involved in it find there's satisfaction, isn't there? There's real satisfaction in getting involved in these little projects. You're not going to really get paid a lot of money or any money at all. And doesn't Google have its own set of citizen science stuff that you can get involved in?
Yeah, they've been launching some interesting stuff along those lines. IBM has been getting involved recently. They have a thing called the World Community Grid that has a lot of these, it's kind of a clearinghouse for a lot of these kinds of projects.
Amazon, too, is involved?
Well, they have a thing called the Mechanical Turk, which isn't exactly a citizen science thing, but it's sort of a crowdsourcing platform that I don't know if anyone's used it for a science project yet, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Arvin Smith, any final recommendations for us or any hints of how to be effective as a citizen scientist? How to be most effective as a citizen scientist.
I think the thing I would encourage people to do is to find a project that interests them and then go and I think where the science really happens is when you begin to discuss with your peers what's happening there. So I think, the science shouldn't be a solitary experience. I think sharing your thoughts and getting into discussion with other people is one of the most fantastic things about science. So I would encourage people to come along to the Zooniverse if they're looking for something they can do in a web browser or if they want to try something at home, then there's lots of data collection projects too. So I would encourage them to get involved and get talking to people.
A couple of other resources that might be useful for people who are interested in just looking for projects to get involved with. There's the Citizen Science Alliance, which I believe GalaxyZoo is involved with, which is kind of a consortium of projects. There's also a site called scienceforcitizens.net that is a kind of a clearinghouse where they try to catalog a lot of these projects and just present a listing so that you can sort of peruse and see what looks interesting.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to David in Lumberton, New Jersey. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, good afternoon. What a wonderful show you have.
Thank you.
Steady listener as well. I'm a global revitalization advocate, and I've written recently about the idea that it would be great if we had a pool for children, anybody really, but especially for children, because they're such a great source for ideas with open hearts and minds, where they could just go and pour in their inspiration and ideas for how to renew the planet, a region, a community, their neighborhood. And at revitalize.com, which is a new web tool for revitalization, they can set up a forum for their community or neighborhood and begin doing that using the tools on the website to structure what's called a renewal engine, which has all the components in it to help drive the renewal project.
Well, thanks for sharing that project with us. 1-800-989-8255. Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a research scientist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and related to your previous guest, we actually use satellites to monitor our water quality throughout the state as well. I'm more on the research aspect side of it, but we rely heavily on a huge citizen-based monitoring program we have throughout the state where citizens citizen scientists will go out onto lakes throughout the state and measure water clarity with Secchi discs. They basically lower this black and white disc into the water, count how many feet until it disappears, and then we use this data to calibrate our satellite regression model such that if 40 lakes in the county are measured by citizens, well, we can make pretty good estimates about what the other 400 lakes, what their water quality is like based on these citizens that are out there collecting this data for us.
Wow, that's a terrific project. Wow. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Jason in Cambridge, Mass. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I had to call because you mentioned it earlier, and I've been highly committed to a biological project for a long time, which is taking roadkill off the road and giving them, like, a decent burial or something. And I've been doing this for years and have, observed and, done this. I know a lot of the conditions, the road conditions, the type of injuries and stuff, but I haven't, if someone's actually interested in that sort of data, I'd be, glad to pass it along as this project continues. And on the subject of discussing with one's peers, I've met in the middle of doing my act of respect to animals, I've met other people who are doing the same thing and offer to help or watch out for traffic or whatever.
Alex?
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned you live in Cambridge. I'm not sure if there's a project along those lines going on in Massachusetts. I know there is one in California. It's called the California Roadkill Observation System, and that's up and running. Might be worth looking into, and they might be able to point you in the right direction if there are other folks working on similar initiatives near you.
And would I just Google that and find them?
You should be able to find it that way, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Thank you very much. There's a sign. Somebody's collecting. There have been books written on roadkill. I have some of them in my office. How to identify what it is, from roadkill. And there were books written on how to identify what's on your windshield.
Interesting.
The bugs that get killed.
Yeah,
on
people
it.
Are coming up with some really interesting offbeat kinds of projects. There's another one called the Gravestone Project.
Where tell us about that.
That's where there's a group that's trying to look at the acidity of rainfall by having people go out into graveyards, and what they're finding is that gravestones are actually provide excellent indications of changes in the acidity of rainfall over time because they've been there for a long time, and they basically the people who participate in the project use a little device called a micrometer, and they go out and they take measurements and then they contribute them, and so they go out and they transmit the location and then they gather this data on it. Seems to be working.
Well, I just got a little hint in my earphones. wildlifecrossing.net/California. That is the roadkill.
Okay.
The roadkill central, I guess we'll call it if you want to report and be a citizen scientist and report roadkill. I guess there are all kinds of things. I remember when I was a kid spotting satellites and things like that.
Yeah, there's some great projects for kids. There's one called Pigeon Watch that's sponsored by Cornell. It's specifically geared for sort of urban kids who maybe don't have a lot of ability to go out in the kind of in the wild, but they can go and capture observations about pigeons in the city and submit them. Cornell does a lot of work in this area. They do a project called Nest Watch as well, which is a national project where they try to get data about birds' nesting habits. And they're actually using that right now to track the impact of the Gulf oil spill. And that's yielding some really useful information, it seems.
Mm-hmm. And anything else that you want to point out?
I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of these projects. It's hard to know where to start. But
I'm sure it's easy to find them on the internet.
They're kind of all over the place, but it takes a little digging, but they're not that hard to find.
Mm-hmm. Arvin, what about the Ship Weather Project?
Yeah, so this was a bit of a different project for us. We're aiming at the Zooniverse to be a place where people can find projects where they're pretty much guaranteed that their efforts will produce a real academic output. So we call, papers in academic journals. Up until Old Weather, which is oldweather.org, we haven't actually done anything other than astronomical research. So we're astronomers. We know lots of other astronomers. So we knew planetary scientists and did Moon Zoo. And it was a while before we spotted a really great project that we thought our community could contribute to that wasn't astronomy research. And this is a project called Old Weather. And Old Weather asks people to look at Royal Navy logbooks from the First World War, for what they call the extended First World War period, so from about 1913 to about 1923. And the great thing about military naval vessels is that six times a day they record the weather. They record what the sky is like, what the sea is like, the temperature of the sea, the temperature of the air, and just general conditions measurements. So, and of course, because ships move around, you basically have this mobile weather station that's sampling the weather at an individual time. And these are calibrated scientific instruments trained.
And you can collect this data from all these records, the ship records?
Yeah, so the National Archives in the UK have huge, huge numbers of these ship's logs books that have been digitized, and they're just sitting there waiting to be, they call it keyed, so actually transcribing the records out of these logs. And, so we've got about 250 ships from the First World War, and it's about 250,000 log pages in there, and we've been asking people to transcribe the data from these logs. And the point about the value of the data set is that actually modern climate researchers are very, very interested in what was happening with the weather 100 years ago, because it allows them to test their models. Mm-hmm. If you can build a model that can accurately tell you what the weather was doing 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, yesterday, then you can begin to get a better handle on what the weather will be doing in 50 years' time as well.
Wow.
They call it atmospheric reconstruction models. So they reconstruct the weather. And to know if you're getting it right, you need to have lots of observations of old weather.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Citizen Science This Hour and Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Alex Wright and Arvind Smith. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
Very interesting information. If you want to be part of any of these, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got all kinds of resources for you to participate as a citizen science. Alex Wright is author of Glut: Mastering Information Through the Ages. Arvind Smith, technical lead for the Galaxy Zoo and the Zooniverse, a terrific site also for you to check out at the University of Oxford in England.